When you're running away from your life, you don't have the time to plan, prepare, and gather the information and the evidence that you need to support an asylum case.
This is Voices on Genocide Prevention from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. I'm Bridget Conley-Zelkich.
Is Bridget Conley-Zelkich, and with me today is Philip Schrag, who is a professor of law at Georgetown University, and David, you have to help me pronounce your...
Garoy
Kenny,
yeah.
Who is a victims advocate at the State Attorney's Office in Montgomery County, Maryland, and a graduate of the Catholic University Law School. He is also, as we'll be discussing today, a refugee from Kenya, who made his way to the United States, and that's the story we'll introduce now. But I wanted to start, Philip, if you could help our audience understand what precisely is a refugee.
Under the Refugee Convention and under American law, a refugee is a person who has left his own country and is afraid to go back because of a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. The Refugee Convention was passed in response to the Holocaust. It was first agreed to by many countries of the world in 1951, and then a protocol extending it was negotiated in 1967. The United States finally signed on at that point. And in 1980, another 13 years having gone by, the United States enacted a refugee law of its own, echoing the convention, under which a person who flees to the United States, flees from persecution, can obtain asylum in America.
In the book, you also start off with another story, and the book, I should step back for a moment, is called Asylum Denied, A Refugee Struggle for Safety in America, and you are the co-authors. You begin with another example from the Holocaust, and I think it's one that offers a pretty stark example of why a refugee protection system was necessary. You introduce the story of the St. Louis.
Yes, it's a story that I learned about for the first time, I'm ashamed to say, when I visited the Holocaust Museum shortly after it opened in 1993. I thought I knew a lot about the Holocaust, but I didn't know much about America's reaction to the Holocaust. And when I saw the exhibit on the fourth floor of the museum about the ship, the St. Louis, it changed my life, and I stopped everything that I was doing, teaching a law school clinic in disability law, and converted my clinic into a refugee clinic so that I and my students could help to rescue today's victims of persecution. The people on the St. Louis were one of the last groups of people who were allowed out of Nazi Germany in 1939. They got on a cruise ship and with Hitler's okay, and sailed to Cuba, where they thought they could land safely, and they had been given visas to land in Cuba. But their visas were revoked when they got to Cuba because the immigration commissioner had not shared his bribes with the president of Cuba. And they were forced out of Cuba, not allowed to land. The captain of the ship, who wanted to land his passengers, sailed off the shores of Miami, and the refugees could see the lights of Miami from the ship, but President Roosevelt wouldn't let the ship land either, and the refugees had to return to Europe, where about half of them were killed in the Holocaust.
And I'll just say briefly, the museum had a research project where it tracked down the fate of every single person that was on the St. Louis, and we have more information about that on our website. I want to shift now, though, to David, so we can learn more about what happened to you and in your quest for asylum, to be granted safe haven as a refugee. But first, let's start in Kenya, where you grew up. Can you tell our audience what you were doing that made you come under the abuse of your government?
Well, I grew up in Kenya in a very small farming village, tea farming village, back in 1992, when my dad died, I became a farmer. And after I became a farmer, we were not around to grow any other crop in our farms, and we were not around to sell the tea to anyone else except the government agency. And most of the tea that we grew in the crops, once we sold it to the agency, we were only paid a minimum that could not even help us to sustain ourselves. So I organized a peaceful protest against the government, and as a result, I was arrested. And after the arrest, I was tortured and put in a basement cell where I was deprived of water, and they put me in the cell where the water would rise and fall, and constantly I was afraid of getting drowned. And after I was released, I was placed under house arrest and totally isolated from the public. So those who would associate with me at the time were targeted and harassed by the local police. When I came under house arrest, since I could not associate with anyone else, there were Peace Corps volunteers who had been assigned in my district, and one of them had decided to live in my village. And in the course of my isolation, we became friends with these Peace Corps volunteers, and through this American, I met other Americans, and together we crafted this idea of me getting out of the country through a basketball scholarship, even though I had never seen a basketball in my life. And then when I came to the United States, I ultimately went to University of San Francisco and graduated with a degree. And then after I graduated, I realized that I can't go back to my country because President Moi was still the president of Kenya at the time. And that's when I decided to apply for asylum. And Fio and I met at that time, and we started the asylum process.
And I would just say briefly, you know, I said the word torture, and people feel like they know what that means. You explained in one or two sentences what you went through. One of the things that I think is very powerful in this book that you've written together is also to try to bring a little more complexity to how survivors of torture continue to suffer the effects and the challenge it presents for them in so many ways beyond, you know, whatever neat and tidy words we might be able to come up with for what you went through. Mm. Philip, can you pick up there then? David has brought us through his political activism in Kenya. He came to school, and the story of the intersection of your life with basketball is, or the idea of basketball, is actually one of the almost comical threads through the book. But then the decision to apply for asylum, what were the challenges that he faced?
Well, the first challenge was that he applied for asylum without having a lawyer. Nobody should do that. This is a complex legal process. And the chance of winning asylum without a competent lawyer at your side is very, very poor. So he went to the first stage of the process, an interview with an asylum officer, unrepresented, and he got a few facts wrong. He had actually addressed a crowd during his political protest. He had addressed a crowd of 30,000 people, and he said that it was about 100,000 people to the asylum officer. The asylum officer figured if it had been 100,000 people, she would have some way of knowing about it, and so she thought he was lying and denied asylum. Then he came to Georgetown Law School, thinking that since he was now facing a deportation hearing in which he would either be deported or he could try again to seek asylum, he better get a legal degree so that he could represent himself. And a dean at Georgetown Law School said, "Oh no, you don't need a law degree, you need a lawyer." And fortunately, we have a clinic here at Georgetown Law School that represents asylum seekers for free in immigration court. So I'm the director of that clinic, and he and I met at that time, and my students represented him in a hearing in immigration court. They prepared for months, they worked very hard, they did everything right, and still they lost. And the reason they lost, the reason Mr. Kenny was ordered deported back to Kenya, was that after his sophomore year of college, he had received a letter from his family in Kenya saying that his little brother, a brother he had brought up as his own son after his father died, had been arrested and was being tortured in a prison in Kenya. And he immediately dropped everything and flew to Kenya, hired a lawyer, got his brother out of jail, even under the eyes of the police in Kenya, who were watching him at the time, who were watching Mr. Kenny at the time, because he had returned to Kenya, and he immediately flew back to the United States to resume his studies at the University of San Francisco. Well, because of this quick trip to rescue his brother, the immigration judge, said he no longer qualified for asylum. It proved that he wasn't afraid to go back, and he had lost his refugee status. And I guess she was trying to prove the adage we sometimes read on bumper stickers that says no good deed goes unpunished. He might have won on appeal had it not been for the fact that 9/11 occurred just then. And John Ashcroft, then the Attorney General, in response to 9/11, made three changes in the Board of Immigration Appeals, the appellate body for asylum cases. He fired summarily five Clinton administration-appointed members, not the people with the least seniority on the Board of Immigration Appeals, but of the 17 members, the five who had the most experience representing immigrants or teaching law, so that the board became a much more conservative body. And he told the board to stop writing opinions. It could affirm denials of asylum without writing opinions, but to reverse a denial of asylum, it had to write an opinion. So it became much easier for the board to affirm a denial of asylum and order somebody deported than to do the opposite. And finally, he told the board to stop deciding these cases in panels of three with some deliberation, but a single member of the Board of Immigration Appeals could affirm a denial of asylum. And so the board, in 1 month or a few months, the board's rate of reversing denials of asylum fell from 37% to 13%. And in that gap fell Mr. Kenny, whose deportation order was affirmed. And eventually he had to return to Kenya, where he was once again, not to Kenya, but to Tanzania, because he was afraid to go back to Kenya. And in Tanzania, the Kenyan government sent agents to surveil him and watch him, and he was in danger even in Tanzania. And in fact, in Tanzania, he was nearly murdered once again. But as you know, because he's talking to you here, he's back in the United States, safe at last. How he got there is a long story that, of course, is told in the book Asylum Denied.
Yeah, and told very eloquently, with each new hurdle coming up before him, an incredible frustration as a reader trying to understand the story. David, can you talk about what it was like to engage with this asylum or immigration system from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, it was more of that, I come from back in my country where, you know, if you take anything to the judge, the biggest bidder pays the judge and gets the judgment. So going to the legal process here in America, it never occurred to me that American legal system, any legal system in America, could be based on the whims and of the judge or individual discretionary decisions. So it became very confusing for me, especially when working with Theo, and Theo will, once, you know, again and again would deliver these bad news to me, and especially telling me, look, you know, you qualify as a refugee. The law is very supportive of your position, but we lost because you did something good. And it was very confusing, particularly when I went back to Tanzania, and we were trying to get one wave after waiver being waived, because after being deported, I was technically barred from coming back here for 10 years. And I was already married to an American, so here my wife is here, and I'm out there in America. So we had to apply for a waiver. And while I was there, I meet with this consular officer who initially becomes very helpful and gives us all the sweet talk that tells me that this that makes us convinced that she's willing to help us. But then she goes through this turn that, you know, having lived in Africa, was very indicative of that we had exposed a corruption racket, or a bribery racket, that one of the local embassy employees were involved with. And she became very angry at us for that. And that almost convinced me that, you know, having lived in Africa, that this person must be involved with this racket, because that's the last thing you'd expect to have an American official respond to. So it was very confusing to me, but then at the same time, I had a very strong belief within the American system that it does work. And the only way you can make it work is when you know what is the right thing to do and you stand by it. At some point, it's by doing that you make the system work. And I think this book is a way of letting the public and letting everybody know how arbitrarily the American legal system, particularly the refugee and the immigration legal system, how arbitrary it is, and how much of changes that needs to be made within this system.
And Philip, just briefly, for people who don't quite understand the difference between the process of getting asylum in the U.S., as you said, that became much more difficult after 9/11, but it is actually much more rigorous process than regular immigration processes.
I can't imagine. I believe it, there was one senator, I think, who said that, you know, the refugee law is going to be used by terrorists to come to America. And I can't imagine any terrorist who would be advised to use the asylum process to come to America, because the process itself is so rigorous that it's equivalent to having your whole life dissected on a table and having like a surgeon with every microscope looking into your life, particularly with the aspect of your identity, before you even qualify for asylum. So even a terrorist is going to try to come to America. That's the last way that they're gonna use. And anybody who would think that they should put restrictions on the asylum process in order to prevent like terrorists coming in here, I don't think that should even be a consideration, because it's a very rigorous process and it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of, the burden is very high in order to qualify to prove your case.
To win asylum, you have to be fingerprinted, prove your identity through documents, and prove that you have a well-founded fear of persecution on one of those grounds I mentioned. That typically takes hundreds of pages of documentary evidence. And that's why an asylum applicant is well advised to have a lawyer, because the lawyer will both compile that documentary evidence and help prepare you as an applicant to testify orally in a way that's believable and consistent with the documents. When a person's gone through trauma and torture as a result of persecution, it's very difficult for them to relive and recall all of their experiences accurately. And it takes weeks of work, often with a mental health professional as well as a lawyer, in order to be prepared to testify in an American court.
Yeah, let me add to Phil's comment, is that you got to keep in mind that most of the people who, especially those who come here seeking asylum, are not people who wake up one morning and they say, I don't like living in my country, I'm going to go and look for a good life in America. And they, like in my case, you know, America wasn't even a country that I ever considered that it was there. It was a place that came about because my first opportunity was to be safe, was to seek safety. Now, most of asylum seekers fall into the same category. They are looking for safety. They are running away from their lives. And when you're running away from your life, you don't have the time to plan, prepare, and gather the information and the evidence that you need to support an asylum case, especially given the amount of documents and the amount of evidence that the system requires in order to be able to prove that you have a well-founded fear. So it's like, imagine someone who is running away for his life and you have someone behind you with a gun shooting at you. And then the person stops by and say, hey, before you shoot me, wait a minute. Can you at least give me a receipt to show me you're shooting me so that if I happen to get to America, I might apply for asylum, and those guys might want to know that you are really trying to shoot me. That scenario is never going to happen because you are running for your life. And that's why a lawyer is very important, because then when you get here, after you get into safety, life becomes very, very, very convoluted. I remember when I came here and I woke up one morning and I realized that I don't have to worry about someone trying to find out where I am or trying to shoot me, that it became so weird that I almost did not want to talk to anybody about what I had gone through, because I couldn't imagine of anybody being able to understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah. David, just as a final question then, can you tell us where you are today and where you're working?
Oh, well, today I work, my wife and I, we live in Montgomery County, we live in Germantown. My son is 2 years and 8 months, and I work at Montgomery County State Attorney's Office. I am hoping to take the bar in a month. Hopefully I'll pass and be a lawyer. And if I become a lawyer, I hope to continue working here as a prosecutor and continue working as a victim's advocate.
And I think the fact that your story ends with you as a victim's advocate says quite a bit about the generosity of spirit that this book documents incredibly well, and what an asset you are to have in our community, in our country now.
Well, thank you.
Thank you both for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Voices on Genocide Prevention from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. To learn more about responding to and preventing genocide, join us online at ushmm.org/conscience.